In Plato's philosophy, the soul is life itself, and it's immortal, and it can never die. That's not true in the Bible. Souls can die. They can't die by guns or cancers. They can't die physically, but there's a place where souls go to die. It's called hell. Hell is never called a place where souls live. It's the place where souls die. And you can see dying souls, although you can't perhaps see totally dead souls even in this life. The Russian author Gogol wrote a story called Dead Souls. Terrifying title. Has psychology lost its soul? That's a good question. I don't know much about it, but I'll tell you what I know. Basically, the answer is yes. That doesn't mean the talk is over. Well, if it's possible for individuals to have lost or dead souls, is it possible for psychology, which by definition is the science of the soul, to lose its soul? Unfortunately, the answer is yes. So, this talk is not going to be a criticism of this bad psychology by a psychologist. Psychology is not my expertise. I'm a philosopher. But it will be a criticism of the bad philosophy that underlies the psychology that denies the soul. Psychology without a psyche. Well, there's different ways to deny the soul. So the first half of my talk is a kind of philosophy lesson that defines the meaning of the word soul. This is boring. Definitions are boring, but they're necessary. Socratic dialogues spend roughly the first 50% of the dialogue defining terms, because if you don't do that, you don't know what you're talking about. So that's like preparing the surface before you paint. It's boring work, but it's most of the work, and it's the most necessary work. So I'll try to do that. Take a deep breath. Try to feign interest in a boring topic, because the interesting stuff will come later. Soul means essentially three things in the history of Western philosophy, both in Greek and in Latin. The fundamental meaning of soul is simply the principle of life. Principle here meaning origin or source. That which gives life to a living thing and distinguishes a living thing from a non-living thing. Now, all living things are organisms, so all life is organic. And in chemistry, as you must know if you know anything about chemistry at all, and I know very little, but I know this much, the principles of inorganic chemistry are radically inadequate to explain the behavior of organisms or organic chemicals. It's a difference in principle. So something happened evolutionarily when life appeared on Earth that wasn't just a gradual process. There was a gradual process before the emergence of life, and then there was a gradual process after the emergence of life. But when life emerged, however it did, and whenever it did, a radically new thing came into being, because an organism works in a fundamentally different way than what is not an organism. Both things can grow, but organisms grow from inside, and non-organisms grow from outside, like the accretion on a crystal. All right, that's the first and most basic meaning of soul. Whatever is alive has a soul. So we have souls, animals have souls, plants have souls. A second, much stronger meaning of the word soul is the principle not just of life, but of feelings, or the whole realm of feeling experience, what you might call animal soul, not just plant soul. And that seems to manifest itself in three different ways: cognitive, affective, and a third way, which isn't nearly as clear or as universally acknowledged, but I'll call it something like creative. First of all, animals have cognition. They have intelligence. It's not human intelligence, but certainly they're intelligent. In some ways, they're more intelligent than we are. They have sensory intelligence. They have intuitive intelligence, internal senses, although they're not human. All right, that's one dimension. A second is affection, or the affective dimension. Animals have desires, felt desires. They feel pain. They feel hunger. They feel sexual desire. They also have more internal instincts, which you might call the animal unconscious. And sometimes these are surprising. Animals can detect things that humans can't sometimes, like approaching earthquakes, or, believe it or not, the presence of demons. Animals are often used as ways of detecting whether this person is a witch or not. That's not a science, and it's not reliable, but there's something in animals that is surprisingly intelligent, and surprisingly instinctive, and surprisingly aware of the attractive and the unattractive. They'll shrink back from something, and they'll long for something in a vague way. Then there's a third thing that animals don't have very much of at all, but they have a little bit of it. It's called creativity. I remember reading about an experiment where they were trying to compare human and animal intelligence by taking some great apes and a cross-section of human beings and putting them in the same situation. They put them both in a 12-foot deep pit in the ground, and they threw a lot of debris in the pit, and they just left them there. And the pit was cold and smelly, and nobody wanted to stay there, and they wanted to see how long it would take the human beings to figure out how to get out and how long it would take the apes. And the walls were sheer, you couldn't climb out, and it was too high, and there was nothing else in there but some debris. Well, the apes, much faster than the human beings, figured out how to make a series of steps out of the debris and climb out of the pit. And more of them got out than human beings. So in some ways, animals can be more imaginative than we, but usually not. Animals have ways of communicating, they have primitive languages, but they can't invent new languages. They don't have artificial languages. There's no plurality of languages among animals. And although they have a kind of primitive technology, they'll do things like beavers will build dams and birds will build nests, but a given species of beaver will always build its dam in the same way, and a given species of bird will always build its nest in exactly the same way. So they're not really that creative. Animals also have some other inkling of this human creativity, or I don't know quite what to call it, appreciation, aesthetic dimension almost, in that the higher animals naturally shrink away from things that are unpleasant to them. That's a primitive version of aesthetics, but it's very primitive. Then, third meaning of soul is distinctly human. The human soul, called the rational soul by the ancients, has three distinctive powers that animals simply don't have. One is the power of reason, that is, the power to understand and to judge and to argue. Reason, in the classic sense, means not just the power of arguing, the power of calculating, the thing a computer can do, but also the power of forming concepts, understanding something, and making judgments. A human being can understand what an apple is, not just sense an apple. And a human being can judge that an apple is a fruit, make judgments about those abstract concepts. And a human being can reason that if an apple is a fruit and a fruit is not a vegetable, then an apple is not a vegetable. Animals apparently can't do that. So we have reason. Second thing we have is free will. We can choose. Animals don't have that, and we know it. Because when an animal does something that we don't like, you don't preach a sermon to it and tell it to go to confession. You simply hit it with the newspaper or something. And if you're a behaviorist and you deny free will, well, that's what you have to do to human beings. Only instead of hitting them, you pat them on the head. It's called operant conditioning. The third thing we have that animals don't have is a genuine creativity and appreciation of beauty. Now, animals have something like that, just as they have something like will and something like reason, but it's only a something like. And sometimes the higher animals will come so close to those human versions of these three things that we wonder whether they're trembling on the brink of humanity. My basset hound embarrasses me sometimes because he looks into my eyes and I'm convinced he's having a mystical experience. He's thinking I'm God. So there may even be some primitive idolatrous religion on the part of animals. But that's a higher soul than animal soul. We've got souls that have reasons that are open to truth and wills that are open to goodness and imaginations and creativity and appreciation that's open to beauty. And that third factor is always the hardest one to formulate. All right, the human soul is more than just functions. It's more than these three powers. There's somebody there who has these powers. Knock, knock. Who's there? Nobody? Somebody's home. Hello? The soul is the seat of personhood. A person is not just a legal term. A person is whatever has these three powers. God has these powers. Angels have these powers. Humans have these powers. And nothing else that we know of in the universe has them. But if there are intelligent life on other planets, then maybe they have them too. But this is a meaning of soul that's much, much harder, maybe even impossible, to define, because it means that you're not just an object, but a subject. You can objectify your powers and what you can do and what you have done, but the one who's doing that, you can't objectify that. You are like a movie. And a movie is two things. It's the projecting machine, which generates the light, and then it's the light and all the images and the motion of the images on the screen, which is what you do, and your powers. Well, the one thing that you can't put on the screen is the projecting machine itself. Because in order to put anything on the screen, there's got to be something more than what's put on the screen, namely the projecting machine that's putting it on the screen. So the deepest meaning of soul, I think, is just that projecting machine, so to speak, that I. When we speak of my mind and my will and my feelings and my body, who's the I that has them? It's something more than that. There's a great quote in my second favorite movie of all time, A Man for All Seasons, or my favorite movie, if you classify The Passion of the Christ as something more than a movie, where St. Thomas More is trying to explain to his simple-minded friend, the Duke of Norfolk, why he can't compromise his conscience and approve Henry VIII's divorce. And he says, isn't there something in Norfolk that's not just the passions of Norfolk or the thoughts of Norfolk, but Norfolk? And Norfolk doesn't understand that. And then later, when he's trying to explain to his daughter why he's going to risk martyrdom in offending the king, he uses a very memorable metaphor. He says, Meg, don't you understand that when a man takes an oath, he takes his self and puts his self in his own hands and offers it there. And if that runs through my fingers, what's left for me? Nothing. It's like the castle keep. It's the last redoubt. That's me. That's why what's really scary in the Gospels is that scene when Jesus goes to Gadarene and meets the demoniac and says, what's your name? And he says, our name is many, for we are legion. He can't say I anymore. He's lost his soul. He's we. That's maybe the deepest meaning of soul, and that's the image of God, because God's name is I Am, the divinely revealed name for the divine nature, the divine essence, revealed to Moses in the burning bush once and for all time. The only time God names himself, not just his relationships to his people, is I am who am. That's why we can say I, because that's who God is. The soul is also a substance, in the Aristotelian sense of the word, a noun and not just an adjective or a verb, an entity, a being. This is denied by a number of philosophers. Buddha, for example, says the soul is an illusion. There is no substantial soul. There is just all the things in you, and therefore you don't have to fear anything because there's nobody there. A favorite Buddhist parable is a man went out sailing even though he couldn't swim, which is very foolish. A storm arose, and he tried to get the boat back into the dock and couldn't get there because there was another boat always blocking its way. And the waves got bigger and bigger, and the man got more and more afraid. And sure enough, finally, the storm sunk his boat, and he was drowning. And the other boat that blocked his access to the dock, which would have saved him, came about 20 feet away. So he shook his fist and shouted at the sailor who was responsible for his life, but he couldn't see who was in the boat. And then he went down, bobbed up again. This time the boat was 10 feet away, and he could almost see the sailor. And he shouted a curse at him and clenched his fist, but he couldn't see him. And he went down again, and he came up for the third time. And just before he went down for the third time and drowned, the boat passed within a foot of him, and he saw who was in the boat. Nobody. And therefore, he couldn't shout at anybody, and he couldn't clench his fist. And he unclenched his fist, and he drowned, but in a state of perfect nirvana, because there was nobody there to hate. That's the gospel of Buddhism. There's nobody there to hate. Well, maybe so, but that means there's nobody there to love either. And that's too big a price to pay. David Hume is the modern philosopher who teaches the same thing, based on, I think, faulty logic rather than Buddhist mystical experience. But there's no substance. There's just what you do and what you are. There's nobody there. It's basically the bad knock-knock joke. Knock-knock, who's there? Nobody. Nobody who? Nobody you. All right, another thing about the soul is that the soul is created by God. The soul is not something that could possibly have been evolved. I still do not understand why Protestants are so afraid of the theory of evolution and Catholics aren't. I don't know what there is in the difference between Protestants and Catholics which make Catholics say, okay, so bodies evolve, so big deal. God can do that if he wants to. Who cares? The Protestants are terrified of the notion. I don't know why. But they both agree and this is very clear in Humanae Generis, that the soul has to be directly created by God all at once. It's not a partial thing with parts that can gradually evolve from matter. You can't get mind out of matter any more than you can get life out of machines. You can't get blood out of a stone, and you can't get souls out of evolution. It's like a transition from non-existence to existence. And because the soul is a person and a substance and created by God, the soul's immortal. Now, the ancients knew that. At least Plato did. He had some good arguments for the immortality of the soul. The soul is not the kind of thing that can die. It is related to the body much more closely than Plato thought, but yet it's a different kind of thing. Bullets can't kill it. Cancer can't kill it. Plato's simple argument for the immortality of the soul in Book 10 of the Republic is that no matter how diseased souls get, the disease can never kill a soul. What's the worst diseases a soul can possibly have? Moral vice and foolishness, a lack of wisdom and virtue. Well, nobody is so bad or so foolish that there's no soul left at all. Well, if even the soul's own worst diseases can't kill it, how could the diseases of something else, like the body, possibly kill it? There's another argument in Plato, the Phaedo, which Thomas Aquinas picks up. It's basically that the soul is a simple thing. It's not a compound. It's not that which gets life from something else. It is the very source of life itself, and therefore it can no more lose its life than a triangle can lose its triangularity. Now, you don't need faith, only reason, to know all of this. That there's three levels of soul. That the soul is the seat of the experience we call I. That the soul is a real entity. That the soul can't have evolved merely from matter. And that the soul is immortal. I think good philosophical reasoning can prove all of that. I don't think, though, that good philosophical reasoning can go so far as to answer the most important question about the soul. What is it for? What is its destiny? What is its purpose? And to use a wonderful formula from Augustine, the answer is the soul is capax dei. The soul is capable of union with God, capable of deification, theosis. It can know God. It can love God. It can enjoy God, but not just from a distance. It can be transformed into something that participates in the very divine life, but not by nature, only by grace. Or it can refuse that. It can refuse to know him, can refuse to love him, can refuse to enjoy him. That's hell. Now, that, I think, comes only from religious revelation. That's the deepest secret about the human soul. That's the destiny of the human soul. But I think even this mysterious, almost mystical revelation has some clues or signs or echoes in purely rational and even scientific psychology. What's the most famous sentence any Christian ever wrote in the history of the world outside the Bible? Almost certainly, it's that sentence on the first page of Augustine's Confessions. Thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. Well, the first part is religious faith. The second part isn't, it's experience. The restless heart, the fact that there has never been a human being in the history of the world who has been completely happy, completely satisfied. Oh, for a little while maybe, but think of the best thing that ever happened to you, the happiest time you ever had in your life, and extend it for a billion years. Wouldn't you be bored? Of course you would. We can't even imagine heaven in a way that's not boring. Our pictures of heaven are boring. They're not moving pictures. Nobody wants to play harps and wear halos and walk on golden streets forever. I remember I had a genuine crisis of faith when I was a teenager. I didn't want to go to heaven because I was bored with church services and I thought that heaven was the church service. What saved me was that verse in the book of Revelation. In heaven there is no temple, no church. Okay. Now I hope that when I go to heaven I'll surf on God. And I can do that forever. I think there are genuine echoes of this deepest destiny of the soul in purely human experience. This is C.S. Lewis's great argument from desire. He says, all of us, if we knew our own heart deeply enough, would know that we want something that we can't understand, can't define, can't formulate, and can't have ever in this world. And yet we want it, and we don't know what it is, because nothing else totally satisfies us. I love Walker Percy's answer to the question, why are you a Catholic? What else is there? That's a great answer. Look at everything else. That's what Peter said to Jesus in John 6 after all the other disciples left. Lord, to who else should we go? All right, so much for what the soul is. Now, how can psychology lose this? This is precious. Every bit of this is precious. And it can lose every bit of this. Let's go through the basic points. I count seven, but I'm bad at math. Maybe it wasn't. Let's go through the 7 points and see how modern psychology, or typical modern psychology, loses the soul at each point. Well, the first and most basic meaning of soul is what raises us above machines and inorganic chemicals. Are there any systems of psychology foolish enough to not recognize that point? Yeah, Skinnerian reductionism. Reducing the complex to the simple is a methodological principle which is very useful in science. Occam's razor is a basic principle of scientific method. Always use the simplest hypothesis that explains all the data. Well, a reductionist then will reduce the human to the animal to the plant to the chemical to the mathematical, and eventually you're nothing but an equation. And for Skinner, there's no fundamental difference between you and a machine, except you're more complicated. I remember reading this illustration, this argument from Skinner. He says, if you drop a stone, do you really think that it has reason and free will to decide where to go? No. Can you predict where it's going to land? Yeah, pretty well. Not exactly, because you don't know all the principles of physics and you don't know how it's going to bounce, but you know it's going to land within, a couple of feet of you. All right, now take something else, which has nothing more in it than a stone has, a piece of paper. It's not alive. Drop that. Can you predict where that's going to go? Well, pretty much, but not as well as the stone. It might fly off and be like a glider for 10 feet or so. So the circle of predictability is maybe 20 or 30 feet for a piece of paper. But that doesn't mean it has free will. All right, now take a plant and let it grow. Plant it. How big is it going to get? When's it going to die? Can you predict that? No, not very well. A little bit, but not as well as the stone or the piece of paper. Well, does that mean the plant has reason and free will? No, it just means it's a little more complicated and harder to predict. All right, now take an animal. Let's say a primitive animal, a fly. You're trying to swat a fly. It's on the window, and it's going to see you coming, and it's going to go either left or right if you hit it straight on. And you can't hit it straight on and successfully kill it. So you've got to figure out whether it's going to go left or right and fake a left and then hit right, or fake a right and then hit left. You've got a 50% chance of killing that fly. Now, suppose you don't succeed. Suppose you think it's going to go right, that it goes left. Has it thought itself out? Like a basketball player making the head fake? Is it clever? Does it have free will? Has it chosen? No. Well, why then can't you predict its behavior? It's more complicated. More things in it than you can know. All right, now go to a higher animal. Here's a dog. Are you going to be able to successfully train that dog? Is the dog going to be affectionate to you? Is it going to form lasting bonds with you? That's even harder to predict than how the fly is going to work. But it's just a more complicated machine. There's nothing in the dog that's not in the fly. Nothing in the fly that's not in the plant. Well, go to a human being now. Much more complicated than a dog, but only a matter of degree. And there's so many unpredictable instincts, parts of the human machine, that even animals don't have, that predicting and controlling human behavior is much, much more difficult than doing so to animals. But it can be done, and it should be done, and let's do it so that we have a perfect world. That's B.F. Skinner. Winston Churchill attended one of Skinner's lectures towards the end of his life, and Skinner concluded his lecture by saying that in the world of the future, using my scientific psychology, human behavior will be predicted and controlled with 100% infallibility. At that point, Churchill got up, and before he stormed out of the room, said, I thank the good Lord that I will be dead before your world comes into being. So some people, the mechanistic materialists, deny even the most basic meaning of soul for the sake of reducing the complex to the simple. But that's rather extreme. But you find that. I don't know of any system of psychology which reduces souls to vegetables, which admits that they live but denies that they have animal emotions, sensations, and desires. There could in principle be such a thing, but I don't know of any. But there certainly are a lot of systems of psychology that reduce man to a complex animal. In fact, that's almost mainline psychology. Freud is a classic example. As a philosopher, I am amazed at how clever Freud can be as a practical psychologist who discovers wonderful new things like dream analysis and Freudian slips, and how primitive and naive he can be as a philosopher. He says all reasoning is only rationalizing. And in his most philosophical book, Civilization and Its Discontents, he ends on the very last page by saying, this is a complex question that I've asked. Why are we discontent? I don't know, is his basic answer. He's honest enough to admit that he doesn't know. And then he says, there's only one thing I know for sure. Only one thing is certain. And then comes the only sentence in the book that couldn't possibly be certain because it's logically self-contradictory. That all of our answers to these questions are nothing but rationalizations of our desires. That all reasoning is rationalizing. Well, in that case, that piece of reasoning is also rationalizing, and it destroys its own credentials. I think you've got to make a very sharp distinction. It's hard to make it sharp, but you've got to make it with somebody like Freud, who has a practical dimension, a psychological theory dimension, and a philosophical theory dimension. You can learn a lot of practical stuff from him. His psychological principles are terrible, and his philosophical principles are absurd. But the absurdity of some of the philosophical principles shouldn't make you blind to his genius in discovering some things. But in that one book, I remember, on facing pages, there's, on the one hand, the great question, now that we, by science and technology, have fulfilled the fairy tale wish that the ancients used to create their gods, we want to be gods. We want to be Zeus in control of thunder. We want to be Mercury in control of communications. We want to be Neptune in control of the ocean. We don't need Zeus and Jupiter and Neptune anymore because we are in control of those things. And what everybody wants is happiness, and that's the wish for happiness. Okay, now that we no longer need religion or gods because we're the masters and conquerors of nature, why aren't we happy? What a wonderfully simple question. What a profound question. And then on the next page, almost, he says, the origin of civilization owes a lot to the fact that primitive man discovered that he could control fire by peeing on it. And thus, the differentiation between men and women and the rest of social organization comes from the fact that man's anatomy enables him to pee on the fire without being burned, and women's doesn't. And he's serious. He doesn't think that's funny. Freud is wonderful. But to see reasoning as rationalizing is, I suppose, the professional temptation of the professional psychologist. Can you deny the next point that I made? Personhood. That there's somebody there, that there's an I. Oh, easily. That's a very hard thing to grasp. Even somebody who admits it can deny it in the next sentence. Kant is a good philosopher to look at it that way. Because in his most famous work, most read work anyway, namely Fundamental Principles of the Metaphysic of Morals, he tries to formulate the fundamental, ultimate principle of all morality, and he does it in three ways. He calls it a categorical imperative. And the first way is just a justice principle. It's basically the golden rule. Do only that which is dictated by a principle which says you want other people to do it too. And the second is a wonderful principle. It says, treat every human being as an end, not as a means. Every human being must be treated with respect and dignity rather than use. Wow, that's John Paul II. But then his third formulation of principle is the principle of autonomy. There can't possibly be a God who interferes with ethics, because then your ethics would be not autonomous but heteronomous. So you are the creator of morality. You have to create it in the same way in order to be rational, so it's not individualistic. We all have the same morality. But this is something that we make. So the I here becomes so intense that it's a divine I and not a human I. And in his other famous book, The Critique of Pure Reason, which nobody reads because that's much too difficult, his own servant, Lumpy, who I don't know whether he was Lumpy or not, but his name was Lumpy. He read everything his master wrote, and he wouldn't finish the Critique of Pure Reason. And Kant asked him once, why you'd never finished my favorite book? And he says, because I want to be your servant until the end of your life, but if I finish reading this book, I will not be able to be your servant anymore, because the only place I could possibly finish reading this book is in the insane asylum. So it's a very difficult book. But the main point of the Critique of Pure Reason is what Kant calls the Copernican Revolution in philosophy, according to which all the meaning in the world is created by the human ego in a kind of unconscious way. There's no space and time out there, as far as I know. It's just the way I see things out there. And there's no substance or causality or actions or reactions or relations in the objective world. Those are just the categories I have to think. And we can't know whether there's a God or whether there's a human self or whether there's a world, but we have to think in those three categories. Oh, good grief. He caught it for a minute. We're created persons. We're finite persons who must treat each other as absolute ends and not as means. And then he loses it and confuses that with God. So that's a hard thing to grasp. You can get under it and deny the I, and you can get over it and say the I is divine. And to keep that precious I on a human level, that's tricky. My next point, that the soul is a substance, that's, I think, very commonly denied by those who see the soul as a kind of a process, which is simply the product of conditioning. You are what your society makes you, that sort of thing. There's no real individuality. If you deny soul in these senses, it's almost inevitable that you're going to deny that the soul is the kind of thing that couldn't possibly evolve. Because evolution seems to be the fundamental principle of nature, and to deny that the soul evolved means that the soul is something supernatural. It comes from beyond nature. It takes a miracle to make a soul. So that's almost an inevitable consequence. Well, what about life after death? I suspect that even those who personally believe in life after death are reluctant to talk about it in public or bring it into their professional work. I remember an Anglican curate who was once asked, "What do you think will happen to you when you die?" And he replied, "Well, I suppose I should enter into eternal bliss, but I really don't like contemplating such depressing subjects." Almost all of our modern culture conspires to make us believe that our meaning and destiny are in this world. If there's anything that's disreputable and disrespectable in polite circles, it's supernaturalism. Even in the church, that's the genesis of the master heresy of modernism, the denial or watering down of anything supernatural. Well, if there's no life after death, why should we love each other? If we're not made in God's image, why should we love each other? If we don't have intrinsic dignity, why should we love each other? If we're just processes, why should we love each other? But almost everybody agrees that we should love each other. So I think modern psychology has not only lost its soul, it's also lost its conscience. Because if its conscience says you must love your neighbor, that's the one thing you know for sure. And if decent philosophy says, but there's no reason to love your neighbor unless your neighbor is real and substantial and an I and has intrinsic dignity and is not just an evolved animal, there's an inner tension there. And that's good, because we can appeal to that. Suppose you're trying to make a prospective convert. If they're perfectly happy with where they are, and there's no inner tension, you're not going to make a dent. But if they're unhappy, if there's something in their soul that gives them a split soul, you can appeal to one half of it against the other. And I think that's true of the modern secular psychologist. The deepest and last step that the soul is capable of union with God, capable of being transformed into something literally divine, by grace, of course, not by nature. That's, I suppose, even rarer. And even many religious people are reluctant to do that. As an ex-Calvinist, I never heard anything remotely like that in my first 21 years from Calvinism. I think Calvinism is a lot like Islam. It's deeply respectful of God, but it's very afraid of that intimacy. And Islam, too, has a profound concept of the divine nature and the divine transcendence, but don't get too close. Except for the Sufis, who most mainline Muslims label heretics, no Muslim would dream of even talking about love with God, much less intimacy with God. It's a form of deism, which is a kind of a popular compromise, because on a beautiful day, you don't really want to be an atheist. You want to have somebody to thank for all this stuff. Beautiful days are awful days for an atheist. They really test his faith. On the other hand, when some real trouble happens and you have to just throw everything into the trust bucket and give it to God, God becomes problematic to you. So deism is a nice compromise. It gives you religion when it's comfortable, and God's like a book on the shelf. Pull him down when you want and read him. But he's not the hound of heaven. He won't pursue you, and he won't make your life uncomfortable. So what do we do about this problem? That God, the real God, seems to interfere with these ways that modern psychology has shown that man can lose his own soul. Well, in light of the fact that Christianity is not just theism, but also humanism, that is, the essence of Christianity, Christ, is perfect man as well as perfect God, you've got to do these two things together. You can't have one without the other. You can no more have the reality of God without the dignity of man than you can have the dignity of man without the reality of God, unless you're a deist. So it's all or nothing, so it's got to be all. Now, I wish I could give you a third part of this talk and buttons to push to make this happen. How to convert our culture, how to convert modern psychology, how to convince everybody that there is a soul, and this is what the soul is, and you've lost it, and you must change your mind. Unfortunately, I can't do that, but you can. We all find ways to do that in our talking, which is not just reading a text, but dialoguing, responding to people's needs, and in our living. So I think you already know the answer to the most important question. How do you help people find their soul? By showing yours. Now, like Aristotle, I'm going to say, at this point, the most precious thing begins. Are there any questions?
This is a trick question for being by.
Good.
The Taoist psychological term has included the word spirituality, and it is invoked as frequently as the terms that they use for religion, which is religiosity. Since about 2003, if my memory serves, maybe earlier, 1999, who had soul is actually included in the Thesaurus, the psychological term. So I put the question again. Has psychology lost the soul? Has it not regained it?
No. What is meant by spirituality, what is meant by spirituality in our culture is the Gnostic heresy, a sort of a semi-pantheistic, vague wafting up of incense into the nostrils of receptive heaven. It's certainly nothing like the hound of heaven pursuing you.
I should remove my mask and say that there was an attempt to change the name of the division of psychology and religion to the psychology of religion and spirituality. I will promote it.
Notice the difference, even grammatically, between religion and spirituality. Religion comes from religio, or religare, which means binding relationship. It's a dialogue. Spirituality doesn't connote that at all. Spirituality is just what you are. I'm spiritual.
Do you think that means that religion is institutional, bad?
Yes.
And spirituality is experiential, good. That's
well, you know what the crucial difference is. Spirituality doesn't have 10 commandments. It has values. It's soft and squishy like the Pillsbury Doughboy. So instead of the church militant, you have Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Yes?
I don't know if I can articulate this in this very intelligent audience, because I'm not a psychologist. I'm just a journalist, a public relations person who likes John Paul II's theology of body. Mm-hmm. And as I learned theology of body, not from this erudite audience's understanding of it, but the idea that, you know, the idea that John Paul II wrote it sort of to combat Descartes' idea of splitting the body and soul, and I think, therefore, I am. I mean, we're just talking about evolution, and the idea that Catholics have no problem with the body evolving, but the soul not.
Mm-hmm.
How can you bring those two understandings together? That's confusing me.
Descartes doesn't talk about body and soul. He talks about body and mind, much more abstract than soul. The soul, by definition, is the life of the body. Angels don't have souls. They're pure spirits. There's no life of the body in an angel, because there's no body to angels. So for Descartes, man is an angel plus a machine, or a ghost plus a machine. Now, that's one reason John Paul II gives his Christian anthropology. A more immediate and practical reason is it's the answer to the sexual revolution. The church always formulates its profoundest creeds in order to answer its deepest heresies. And here's the great heresy of modern times. Here's the most destructive revolution of modern times. And most people, let's be very honest and frank, most people in our culture do not understand, even though they try to, they don't understand the Catholic take on human sexuality. They don't understand humani vitae. They don't understand the big picture. And John Paul II understands modern man, probably better than any other pope ever did. So he's giving us the big picture there. And almost everybody who studies the theology of the body is remarkably impressed. Oh, good grief. You Catholics love the body. We thought you were afraid of it. So that's God's great gift to the church.
If the soul is not a ghost in a machine, if there are two dimensions of the same thing, how is it the body can evolve but the soul can't?
The body doesn't evolve, the body grows. But the species, man, could evolve from another species on a purely bodily level without a rational soul. You can perform experiments in laboratories on bodies, and maybe it will be possible in the future to artificially induce species to evolve by speeding up natural selection. That's probably a science fiction scenario, but there's nothing intrinsically impossible about that. There's something intrinsically impossible about getting a soul out of that process. Now, once you have an animal soul or a plant soul, you can make that evolve in certain ways, but you can't get the human soul, which is a substance, out of anything else. Substances don't emerge as compounds because they're not compounds. You put hydrogen and oxygen together and you get water, but you don't put any two things together and get a human soul because the eye doesn't have parts. The eye is the skinniest word in the language. So I think it's philosophically impossible to have a soul made out of previous stuff. And evolution is one way of making something new out of previous stuff. So not only can souls not evolve, they can't be produced or constructed. They can't be cloned, for instance. They can only be created. And what we do is we procreate them.
But somehow the body has an effect on the soul.
Of course. Of course. Once the human soul is there in a body, once conception happens, that single soul makes the body replicate on an animal way and eventually becomes the principle of self-consciousness. There was a controversy in the Middle Ages about whether man had one soul, two souls, or three souls, because the function, the biological function of the soul, and then there's the animal function, and then there's the rational function. And there were a number of philosophers, most of them Platonists or Platonic Augustinians, who said, no, there's got to be different souls in the body. And that was an opinion which wasn't officially condemned by the church, but all the great philosophers like Thomas Aquinas denied that because it impairs the unity of the human personality. I had another answer to your question, but I forgot the full question. Oh, why you can't change one without changing the other. Well, can you change the words in a book without changing the meaning? No. Can you change the meaning of a book without changing the words? No. Can you change the notes in a piece of music without changing the sound or the beauty of it? No. Can you change the beauty of it without changing the notes? No. Well, the meaning of a book is to the words of the book like the soul is to the body. We have two nouns there, soul and body. So it's almost impossible for us not to start as Cartesians and think of, here's the soul, it's one thing, the spirit. Here's the body, it's another thing, it's an animal. And then God somehow puts the two together. Not so. The soul is the very form of the body, and the body is the very matter of the soul. If we were to ask Thomas Aquinas, what is the soul made of? He would say flesh and bones. And if you were to ask him, what is that bunch of flesh and bones? He'd say it's the soul. There's nothing else like that. And that's why procreation is so sacred. That's the one repeated miracle by which God creates eternal, intrinsically valuable beings over and over again. The womb is like the altar. It's the place where God repeatedly comes into the world and does what only God can do, create. When the priest says, "This is my body," God becomes incarnate again. And when a man and a woman say to each other in sexual intercourse, "This is my body," God creates images of himself again and again. Those are the two holiest places in the universe.
If and when scientists are able to clone a human being, is that the same soul or a different soul?
No, it's a human soul. I don't think that's a fundamentally different moral problem than, let's say, rape or incest. That's the wrong way for human beings to come into the world, but it's not their fault, so we have to treat them with dignity.
For a room of potential converts, could you explain the effects of surfing on the soul?
Well, it's a cheap way of getting mystical experiences. And getting out of your body. But there are many ways of having out-of-body experiences. Music is one. Great literature is another. Just being totally in love with somebody. God designed us to have out-of-body experiences. That, I think, is the deepest reason why sexual temptations are so difficult to overcome and why we are so addicted to sexual pleasure. Because God designed us for ecstasy. Not just happiness, not just satisfaction, but ecstasy, out-of-body experiences. And the most ecstatic thing about sex is not simply the animal pleasure of it, but the fact that that other human being has allowed me into his or her own inner sanctuary, so that I can give my whole self and forget myself to the other and become the other. There's a kind of joyful overcoming of all responsibility and self-consciousness in that act. So we're geared for that. It's an icon of the Trinity. That's the ultimate foundation of the whole theology of the body. God is eternal, infinite, total ecstasy of self-giving. And sex is an image of that. That's what makes it so holy. That's why I think we can learn something precious about ourselves from addicts, not just sex addicts, but alcohol addicts or drug addicts or any kind of addicts. The addict is looking for a way of escaping himself and self-consciousness. And he's looking for some of the best things in the world in some of the worst places. Because if that is what we're hardwired for, then we have to search for it and we have to grab at it no matter what the cost. God didn't make us to be sheep or goats or Canadians. He made us to be passionate lovers. Sorry.
I had a dispute with some people over your article, Is There Sex in Heaven? Where I was pointing to the language and saying that you weren't speaking literally when you were speaking.
I was speaking literally.
You were speaking literally. Okay, then I'll prolong. Can you?
In that article, which comes from a book called Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Heaven But Never Dreamed of Asking, I start by saying most people use the word sex wrongly. They think it's something you do, not something you are. It's something you are. And God doesn't destroy that which you are. We do different things in heaven. I see no need for sexual intercourse in heaven, just as there's no need for eating in heaven. But what you are as a human being includes your femininity or masculinity. That's not just a bodily accident, because the psychosomatic unity, that's a thing in your soul too. God doesn't destroy that. And since the body reflects the soul, you will have a male or a female body in heaven. Jesus isn't going to suddenly lose his sexual organs in heaven. Neither are you.
But at the resurrection, they are neither given in marriage nor married, but right. Like the angels in heaven.
Like the angels in heaven, how? Not in lacking bodies, but in not marrying.
But you had a line in there, I think it was something like spiritual sexual intercourse, and that was what I was arguing was not meant to be taken literally the way that
Oh, right. Absolutely right. That's why I use the word spiritual. Even in this life, if you can have a relationship like Francis had with Claire, which is purely holy and spiritual, but deeply intimate and deeply loving, that's a kind of a foretaste of heaven. That's what I meant by spiritual intercourse.
But didn't the church reject courtly love?
Courtly love, yes, because that was physical. The difference being that courtly love was erotic. Francis and Claire did not have an erotic relationship. Courtly lovers had either a suppressed or a non-suppressed erotic relationship. Even when they kept it pure, it was a suppressed eroticism. Dennis de Rougemont has some interesting things to say about love in the Western world, about courtly love. Interesting, but confused, and not really completely human.
Well, I just finished actually reading Don Quixote, which is much different than the movie. Everything you've seen in the movie is the first 100 pages, and the book goes to 900.
Yeah.
And then it meets close
to the end. Yeah. So, there's something noble about it, and yet there's something dangerous about it.
The notion of the soul seems to have progressively receded in theological discourse in the second half of the 20th century for many people. And I think one of the consequences of that has also been evident in what we say in our worship, or certainly some of the formulations that we use. Do you think that a recovery of the sound principles of psychology could help with our theology?
Works both ways. The psychologist has to help the theologian has to help the psychologist. But if the psychologist's theologians don't talk about souls, then the psychologist can't help the theologian. Most of our traditional theological language, I think, has been on a back burner. We're afraid of the strong nouns, the strong substantial words. We prefer process words. We prefer things that don't shock, that don't have hard corners. I wrote a book that will be coming out in a couple of months called Between Allah and Jesus. The subtitle is What Christians Can Learn from Muslims. And the main point, which is illustrated in a lot of different ways, is that what Christians can learn from Muslims is basically the same thing that Christians can learn from Orthodox Jews, namely the power of the primitive, our own foundations, the fear of the Lord, which is the beginning of wisdom. Because if you forget that, then the love of God, which is not based on that foundation, will be a weak substitute for the real thing. Now, fear of the Lord without the love of the Lord is merely primitive, and I think that's the deepest mistake of Islam. But they have a genuine and pious fear of God, which most of us have lost, and we better learn it again. Otherwise, our love is going to be weak. I have a lot of friends who use language, probably in a careless way, but I like to jolt their thoughts a little bit when they do. And they say things like, God told me this, and God said to me, just do this. And I said, okay, Lord, I'll just, they don't like the word just, I guess. They don't like justice, they like just. I'll just do this to you. I had this great conversation with the Lord, and I say to them, wait a minute. When God appears to somebody in the Bible, they never say that. And even when an angel of God appears to the Bible, the first thing he always says is, fear not. Where's the fear?
But when people talked to Jesus, it was all kinds of reactions. Some of them were falling, some of them were subtle, some didn't even recognize him.
That's right.
Couldn't that be the same in prayer?
It could. It certainly could. And I certainly don't want to be narrow-minded and judgmental and say, I know exactly what's happening to you. God's very tricky. He can do all sorts of different things with our souls.
Just one more question.
Okay. You mentioned that third property of the soul, the part that's hard to define.
Yeah.
Could you comment on the proper expression of that?
Beauty. The creation and expression and appreciation of beauty. That's the third transcendental property. That's an attribute of God that you have to have, that you long for, that's specifically human, that without it you're not a complete and fulfilled human being.
Because there seems to be an emphasis amongst Catholic culture on the proper rational expression and the will, the morals. But somehow the...
That's the deepest... culturally, that's probably the strongest reason why we're losing our culture. The Catholic intellectuals are respected. We've got a great theology and a great moral theology. Catholic saints are respected. But what about Catholic artists? Where are they? Are our pictures moving pictures anymore? They don't move the culture. Where's our Dante? That's a crucial apostolate. This is one of the good things about Jesuit spirituality and Ignatian spirituality. The eye for the divine presence, which includes the true and the good and the beautiful, everywhere. If the scales only dropped from our eyes, we would see ordinary things as magnificent. We'd just be struck. There's a scene in one of the worst movies I've ever seen, American Beauty, which is a very morally compromised movie, which maybe I'm misinterpreting. Maybe I'm just a naive romanticist, but I love this scene. It's this callow little teenage kid who's an amateur photographer, an artist, and he's trying to explain to his girlfriend, who is being seduced by this older guy, why he's turned off on all these adult hypocrisies, but he's into art, and he's made this picture, and he shows you this picture, and it's just a dirty street in a slum with a lot of garbage, and there's a dirty rag there, and it's windy, and the rag is dancing in the wind. And that's all, a dirty rag dancing in the wind. And he says, you know, when I see that, I'm convinced that there's such beauty everywhere that we couldn't endure it. And it's like I'm looking through that rag and I'm seeing something else, some light. I don't know what the words are. But it's as moving as that line in Equus, Peter Schaeffer's play, about the boy who put out the eyes of horses, and he's going to the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist heals him. And at the end, the psychiatrist wonders if he should have healed him, because he's come back now as a well-adjusted teenager and no different than anybody else. And the psychiatrist muses on almost the last page of the play, did I do the right thing? I must confess that I am jealous of him. He has something that I never had in my life. Because when I walk down the road and I turn the next corner and there's a stone wall on the left, I know exactly what I'm going to find. There's not going to be any door in that wall to paradise. There's not going to be any angels. There's not going to be any miracles. Now, this boy who thought horses were gods and worshipped them, he was kind of insane. But at least when he walks down that street and turns that corner, he doesn't know what he might see. He might see a miracle around the next corner. I was moved by that. That's what we need, a world with holes in it. A world where that leaf is not just a bunch of molecules that happens to reflect light waves at certain angstrom units that hit our optic nerves and stimulate our brain to see green. That leaf is a hole in the world. And if you look through the hole, you see the mind of God. And you see the divine idea of green, and it's perfect.